Tonight on Arena, Joker Folie à Deux, A Different Man, and The Teacher are the movies up for review. And Floating on a Dead Sea, a dance piece reflecting on life in the occupied West Bank. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Film reviews first this evening. In Joker, Folie à Deux, Joaquin Phoenix returns to the role that won him an Oscar. This time round, he's joined by Lady Gaga as Harley Quinn, the Joker's all-singing, all-dancing, psychologically disturbed love interest. In fact, there are jazz hands all over the place. It's a musical. Sebastian Stan is one of the most interesting Hollywood actors around at the moment. Soon we'll see him as Donald Trump in The Apprentice. But tonight, he leads up A24's A Different Man, a film that probes questions around our identity. And we spoke to director Farah Nabulsi earlier this week and about her feature film, The Teacher. It tells the story of a former Palestinian freedom fighter turned school teacher, Bassem, who is now trying to quell the cycle of revenge. Arlene Hunt and John McGuire being to the movies for us. They're with me in studio now. We'll start with Joker, Folie à Deux. Arthur Fleck is facing trial for the murders committed in the first film. Along the way, he has amassed quite the following, not least Harley Quinn, played by Lady Gaga. Did I say that John McGuire and Arlene Hunt were our two reviewers this evening? If I did, I'm saying it now. John, when the first film was released, rather stupidly, Todd Phillips said, "There will not be a sequel."
Yeah.
Here we are with the sequel.
To see what happened? Is that what you were going to ask me?
Well,
what happened is $1 billion.
It made a lot of money,
yeah. It made a huge amount of money, unexpectedly.
Yeah.
It won, like you said, Phoenix's Oscar. And it generated acres and acres of newsprint about, you know, repressed incels and male violence and, you know, all of these social issues that were supposedly reflected in this superhero origin story. So that's what happened, even though it was pretty definitively the end. I mean, there's even a title card at the end of the first Joker that says the end. And we would have expected, maybe, if there is to be a sequel, we might see Batman. We might progress the story a little bit. We might see the Joker do those kind of jokery things that we're familiar with from Heath Ledger or Cesar Romero or whoever.
Yeah.
But we don't get any of that. We get a musical. And it's not just a musical in that they didn't write any songs. It's a karaoke musical. It's a jukebox musical of the Great American Songbook, as warbled by Phoenix and belted out by Lady Gaga.
Yeah, okay.
As Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn. And obviously more than a nod to Commedia dell'arte there in the naming of the character Harley Quinn and the Joker face that she has, or something akin to the Joker face that she has in terms of the makeup. But Gotham City is not the most obvious location, Arlene, for a musical, is it?
Well, first of all, you wouldn't know you were in Gotham City, really, apart from the rain. It's raining. It's grey. There's a lot of rain. Because this, disappointingly, takes place mostly in Arkham, which is the Institute for the Criminally Insane, which is where Arthur Fleck ended up at the end of the first film. And I don't know what Todd Phillips' planning on this was, because to take Joker out of Gotham and set him into, there's only really two areas in this, which is a courtroom and Arkham. There's one small screen shot on the street, and that's it. That's the only one, and one sort of slightly outside of where they're dancing in the rain. Oh God, I just realised that's what it is. It's dancing in the rain outside the institute in a sort of semi breakout, which isn't really a breakout at all. So it's really interesting how Gotham isn't part of, you know, there's none of the great skyscapes or the light in the sky or any of the great, like, you know, it doesn't, you don't get that feel for it at all. It just feels really grey, toned. Even the palette, the colour palette is grey. Everything's very grey and dark. And Arthur Fleck himself is like that. He's like a mole. Okay. He's like a mole. He's not like Joker at all. He's like a little mole man in this.
Yes, but he is beloved. He has this kind of, have amassed this huge following.
The Joker has amassed this huge following. The man who went into Arkham, who was on screen, who did these terrible atrocities on screen and went to Arkham because of the atrocities he did and who drove a crowd behind him, or formed a crowd behind him because of who he was. Yeah. He's not in this movie, not really. This is Arthur Fleck.
All right. So
and Arthur
really
Fleck
get...
and the Joker are not the same person.
Oh.
Well, that's partly what the film is about, and we'll get on to what the film is about. But when he's in Arkham...
I thought we had done that in the opening question.
We have not.
When he's in Arkham, he's tormented by Brendan Gleeson, who plays this Irish prisoner.
There's a good reason to stay in Arkham for a long time.
Brendan appears from behind, and you know him immediately. I didn't know he was in the film. You see his ears and his size and his bulk as he walks through the frame, and you're like, that's Brendan Gleeson. And he is really quite superb in this... In this role as Jackie the Tormentor, because he's partly friendly, he shares cigarettes and he does little favours, and then he's partly a bully and a tyrant, and he can change on the flick of a switch. Exactly. Yeah. And Gleeson does that incredibly well. But it's Phoenix as this skinny, emaciated, weak, tired, exhausted character, which is just really quite surprising.
All right, let's listen to Phoenix. I think here as Arthur Fleck, I think this is more Arthur than it is Joker. But Lady Gaga is here quite definitely as Harley Quinn. They are having a conversation in prison. There are bars separating them.
Hey, no touching.
I'm so proud of you. Going crazy for you. You did it.
I don't know. Maybe I should read a law book or something. Until I never went to high school.
I said no touching.
You can do anything you want.
There you go, your Joker. She's reminding Arthur Fleck that's Lady Gaga, of course, is Harley Quinn there. She's reminding him, don't get bogged down in Arthur Fleck.
Well, she needs him to be the Joker because she has attached her entire identity onto him. You know, for her to be Harley Quinn, he has to be the Joker because that's who they are. In canon, that's who they are. They're star-crossed lovers, I suppose, in canon. So she needs this man to be the Joker. Even more than he needs to be the Joker, she needs him to be the Joker.
And that speaks a little bit to what I think the film is about. It's a dreary experience. It's a one-note experience. It's not particularly effective either as a superhero film or as a character study. Mm. But it's really a film that's in conversation with the reaction to the first film rather than the contents of the first film.
So which is very in-jokey and in-talking-to-yourself type of thing.
Because the Joker film became this kind of call to arms for this disaffected majority, you know, young male violence, that incel movement, the kind of internet thing.
Right.
Phillips is looking at that and he's subverting their expectations, obviously, by giving them a musical that's as grey and dreary as it could be. But he's really saying, this is your hero. He's this scrawny weirdo locked in a prison. Why are you following him? And Harley Quinn needs him, but the audience doesn't need him. And the people who are going to see this film are going to expecting another Joker are in for a nasty land because it's not that at all.
They will get to hear some singing, however. Some of it from Joaquin, but most of it, I think, from Lady Gaga, like this.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Like me, they long to be close to you. On the day that you were born, the angels got together and decided to create a dream come true. So they sprinkled moon dust in your hair, a golden starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why.
Devastated. Hear that I don't hear the sprinkles falling down into his hair. That is Lady Gaga singing Close to You from Joker. Now, from Joker Folie à Deux. How do the songs and how does the musical element fit into the story that's been told, Arlene?
Well, it fits around the cigarette smoking and the long grey pauses for character development. I mean, every song is particularly chosen. They're all sort of an era. I don't really know if they're the best choice of song for the characters that they are or not, because I don't really understand why it's a musical. I just don't understand why he decided, why Todd Phillips decided to take this and run with it as a musical.
So
because
you
the people who love this film, and there are a lot of people who love the original film, the people who love the film and love DC and love the Joker and love that type of film, they're going to hate that this is a musical. They're going to hate it across the board.
They're also going to hate that it's this kind of specific musical where the ironies, the contrast between what's happening on screen and the lyrics of the songs that Lady Gaga is singing, those ironies you're literally beaten over the head with.
That suggests that there is some kind of statement from Todd Phillips saying, Do not think
otherwise.
That I was saying something else.
Being very deliberate here. And I think if you ever thought otherwise, I think what he's saying is that then the joke is on you.
Right. Stars from you on this one, John?
Two for me.
Two? Oh, that's a bit...
generous.
Sounds as if it was dreary. Bad day at the cinema.
I think there's bits of it that work.
I gave it two as well. I thought Gaga was fine. Phoenix is fine. Brendan Gleeson, I thought, was great.
Yeah, me too.
So he gave it the little lift that it needed, because every time he was on stage or on screen, that's where the menace was.
All right. Okay. I think I get what both of you thought of it, if I don't really get what the film's about just yet. All right, let us move on to A Different Man. This is an unusual film, I think it's safe enough to say, about identity, confidence and disability. Sebastian Stan plays Edward, an actor and comedian whose face is disfigured by tumours. When an experimental treatment provides a cure, Edward must reckon very seriously with who he is now. I might be being simplistic in the plot there, but Sebastian Stan starts out as this Edward guy, but is effectively gets rid of the problems with his face.
Well, he's an aspiring actor. So that's the first thing. So the first time we really meet him, he's in this kind of infomercial for how to treat members of your, you know, the staff that you work with if they have disfigurements on their faces and stuff. And, you know, he's an aspiring actor. That's the first thing you really need to know about Edward. He wants to act. And unfortunately, he's extremely disfigured from tumours and things like that. And he's, you know, his surface of his skin is really, really badly disfigured. But he is unafraid to be out in public and unafraid to put himself forward. And so you kind of, from the start, you're kind of rooting for him from the start.
As is his neighbour downstairs.
Well, he meets a new lady.
A new lady
next door. And she's next door. And she's an aspiring playwright. And he's an aspiring actor. So they've
right.
a
so
lot in common with that. And it helps that she's really pretty and friendly and very touchy-feely.
But then he gets this master drug that
experimental medical treatment that fixes
everything, and he's a very handsome young man all of a sudden.
Yeah, once we get a little touch of body horror then in the middle when his old face with the neurofibromatosis literally falls off, which is kind of Cronenberg-y, the substance element of that. And then he emerges as Sebastian Stan, this very handsome, very smart and urbane kind of guy, changes his name, changes his job, moves out.
And does he become a very different character?
A very different character. He's now called Guy, and he's a, what do they call it
in America?
A real estate agent. And, you know, he's very cocky and he's making sales and he's going around the city and he's out at night. And one night, when he's out with a group of friends, in walks Oswald, who's played by Adam Pearson. A British actor. Now, if you've seen Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, you'll remember Adam Pearson. You'll never forget his face. He genuinely has neurofibromatosis. He's not wearing a mask like Sebastian Stan is. And who you will remember from an electric scene in the centre of Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. And he walks in and he's all the things that Edward/Guy ever wanted to be. He's funny, he's witty.
Charismatic.
His disability does not in any way define him. Riddled with charisma, and you know, immediately takes over anything. He's a polymath. He can do, you know, he does judo, yoga, all this kind of stuff.
Add into the mix that the former kind of love interest playwright is now writing a play about Edward, and you have all sorts of complications.
Edward follows her and discovers that she's writing the play about him, and then he auditions for the role of himself, and gets the role.
And he wears a mask.
And he wears a prosthetic mask.
That his doctor had given him.
That his doctor had given him as a keepsake. And he, you know, he forms a relationship with Ingrid and everything's going really well, except then Oswald, the charming British, charismatic guy, rocks up in one of the, you know, as another audition or within one of the performances, the pre-performances. And, you know, Ingrid immediately sees him as, ooh, you're actually what the real Edward is like. And actually, I think you'd probably be much better in the role. So now, not Edward, takes over Edward, who's also pretending not to be Edward's role in the play. And, you know, immediately becomes more accessible to everybody.
I have to say, it sounds like a really interesting...
It's fascinating.
It's good fun.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, on top of that, so you've got this kind of Kafka-esque Frankenstein going on. But on top of that, it looks like a 70s movie from Cassavetes or Woody Allen. It's in this grainy, quick, loose,
it worked.
Very loose, very rangy kind of film. And you're into it straight away. Yeah. Now, for me, it fell apart a little bit. There's a lot going on. And Schimberg, the writer and director, loses control in the last 20 minutes or so. But that is a minor
quibble. Negative stars, John?
Three for me. I was really into it.
And you,
I gave it five. I loved it.
Oh, you loved it.
Okay.
What's really interesting, it's asking this question, not only how do other people perceive us, which is, you know, with this facial, but how do we perceive ourselves, which is much more important.
Yeah, all right.
Really interesting.
Let us move on to our final film, film number three, Fire and Abulsi's feature film, The Teacher, set in Palestine. Story centres on Bassem, former freedom fighter, now trying to combat how injustice and tribalism affects his own community. Irish actor Stanley Townsend and Andrew Irvine play the parents of a kidnapped Israeli-American soldier. We spoke, Arlene, with the writer-director Farhan Abulsi on the programme earlier in the week. This is filmed on location.
Yeah, that's right.
With many of the things that are shown in the film, like houses being demolished, olive trees being burned, happening as they filmed.
Yeah. Yeah, they were so lucky just to be able to film there and to be able to film there with such leeway, because it's hostile. It's a hostile environment to be trying to run a film crew and run cameras and have actors and to be able to even do the scenes. I'd imagine it's just so difficult, unbelievably so. But, you know, it's a complicated story. You've got Bassam, he's an English teacher. He has a paternal interest in two of the boys in his class, particularly Adam, who reminds him of his own son, who at the age of 16 went to an Israeli court and was sentenced as a man, basically, even though he was only a 16-year-old boy, for some very minor things like throwing rocks and things like that. And his own wife has left him. So he's in an estranged marriage. He's very alone in his own way. And he really has taken a paternal interest in both these boys, Adam and Adam's older brother. And their home essentially is destroyed. Their entire home is destroyed by settlers and by thing, and they can do nothing about it. And he can't protect them, even though he's in the same village. He can't protect them because, as he says, probably his home is next. And this causes immediately the losing of the home. It snowballs into a much more catastrophic,
violent event, encounter, which takes one of the brothers away, essentially. Yeah. John, what you get then is this idea that the teacher character is trying to say, no, search for justice. That's what you must do here. Look for justice.
Well, that's the question that Adam did, who's played by Mohammed Abdel El Rahman. He asked this question after all you've been through, once he finds out a little bit about the teacher and his backstory, which we won't reveal. After all you've been through, he asks him, you still believe there'll be justice? But after everything that we've watched from the West Bank and from Gaza over the last 12 months or so, does anybody really believe that there'll ever be any kind of justice?
But even he didn't believe. It took him so long to answer that question when he was asked that question. Like, he could see the weight of it on him, because I'm not sure he does believe it. But because of Adam, it was Adam asking him the question. I think he has to kind of say, you know, there will be justice. Please don't go down the path of revenge.
Yeah, exactly,
don't go back down the path of revenge.
He's trying to stop these kids from becoming the kind of person that he was himself. But at the same time, he's continuing to be the person that he used to be, but just on a covert. And when he meets Imogen Poots, who plays an English volunteer named Lisa, who comes in to work in his school, we get a romance. And then we've got the melodrama of the kidnapped IDF soldier and his parents, the Stanley Townsend, Andrea Irvine. And there's a lot going on suddenly.
Let's listen to a scene where the Israeli authorities come to the teacher's house, essentially, because they believe that they, and they're right, but they can't find the guy, that the hostage is being held in the teacher's house. And here's the conversation between the IDF, essentially, and the teacher.
I've read about you from Moldova. Or was it Romania? Your Arabic is not very good. Did you try to learn it there before you came here or after you arrived?
Our sources told us that Nathaniel Cohen had been moved to this village. And we also heard about the teacher.
I see. Your sources told you about the teacher, and you came to see a teacher.
There we go. That's Salah Bakri, the final voice that you heard there, playing the character of Bassem, the teacher of the title of this film. He really carries a lot of this film. There are great actors around him, but he is the
centre of it. He's the moral centre of it because even though he has his own ways of doing things, he's trying to do things because he believes in what he's doing, but he also believes in how he's doing it. And he's trying to fight on all fronts because the IDF soldier that they have as a hostage, they're going to use him to release over 1,000 men. And that's the trade-off. Whereas, you know, young Adam would like to go out and kill the settler because, you know, his vengeance is such hot and raw about it.
Bakri has this kind of, he's a very handsome man, but he has this kind of intensity about him. But at the same time, he has to hold it all back.
Yeah. Wonderful ambiguity.
He's trying to be, and the moral thing is one question, but his... from scene to scene, he's really got to hold back as much as he can.
Did the film work for you overall, John, and stars?
It juggles a lot. There's different tones, different plot strands, not always as smoothly as you'd like. But the message here, you know, this is a terrible situation in Palestine, and it's painted in pretty broad brushstrokes. Excuse me, that's hard to say. But it's unmistakable, the picture that is painted. Yeah. It is unmistakable. So for me, this is a 3-star film, and I think beautifully acted. Beautifully acted.
And Arlene?
I gave it 3 out of 5. I think it's a complex film, clearly on a budget, but I think his performance in particular really just lifted it.
Yeah, this is the Salah Bakri, as the lead character. That is the 3 films that we're speaking about this evening with Arlene Hunt and John McGuire. Joker, Folie à Deux, A Different Man, both of them go on general release tomorrow. The Teacher is in selected cinemas right now. Our London Lives is Christine Dwyer Hickey's highly anticipated new novel. Her last book, The Narrow Land, was about the American artist Edward Hopper and won the Walter Scott Historical Prize for Fiction as well as the Dawkey Literary Award. This time round, the lives in question belong to two outsiders, an Irish teenage runaway, Millie, and a young boxer called Pip, whose paths cross and then part again. The novel follows them through thick and thin and a kind of love story from 1979 through until 2017. Richard Aldous has been reading it for us and he joins me on the line right now. When I say that it's a story that goes from 1979 to 2017, it doesn't fully give a sense of what Christine Dwyer Hickey has done here. She tells these two stories, or tells the story from two viewpoints. The young Millie from 1979 through until the beginning of the millennium, and Pip from the point of view of 2017. Tell me first of all a little, Richard, about Millie's situation when we first meet her back in 1979.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sean. I mean, as you say, this is a sprawling novel that takes in so much, but it starts with this character, Millie, who arrives working in a pub. She's pregnant. She would be a single mother. So we follow that part of the story. She runs in the pub. She runs into this character, Pip, who's a boxer. There's an immediate kind of physical connection between the two of them. And then as the novel kind of sprawls out over 40 years, their lives kind of intersect, then they go their different ways, and then they come apart. And so really one of the things that underlines the whole novel is this sense of, you know, will they, won't they, will they get together and rekindle the very brief relationship that they'd had and make something permanent of it.
I noticed as I was reading the opening section of the book, when Millie is in the pub and she's looking across at Pip, I think it's the first time she sees him, she doesn't even get to see all of him. She sees a little bit of half of his face, and a hand comes up and he's drinking a pint and it obscures his face. And I thought, Christine Dwyer Hickey is going to reveal not only physically this character to Millie, but these characters are going to be revealed to us quite slowly.
Yeah, is it? I mean, this is a very slow-moving book. And, you know, I have to be honest with you, when I first started reading it, I thought I was going to struggle because the pace sometimes is glacial. But as it turns out, this is a very skillful way of revealing these characters because rather than getting to know them superficially, we really do get to know them from the inside. We get to care about them. And so as the novel unfolds, there's a real sense that these are people that we have come to not just know, actually, but to understand too.
And even though we have met Pip in the 1979, that early section of the novel with Millie and their brief fling, as you say, Richard, then we come to the 2017 section of our parts of the book, which is every second chapter, essentially. And there we're looking at a much older man and his situation. He's not a broken man in 2017, but he's a man in recovery and struggling with that.
Yeah, he's pretty broken. There's a sense that his life has really kind of unraveled in ways that have been, you know, terrible for him. There's alcoholism, there's the failed relationships, there's the very difficult relationship that he has with his daughter. He has this kind of very strange relationship that he has with his brother. There's a great line that she uses. And actually, this is a good example of her humour, kind of very sharp humour, whereas at one stage she says it's not that he doesn't love his brother. I'm going to obviously redact this. It's just that he can't effing stand him. And that's kind of very typical of the kind of way in which she writes, that everything kind of is going along in this kind of very reflective kind of way. And then bang, you'll have these lines which either for in terms of wit or in terms of emotion will literally just, to use that boxing metaphor, knock you off your feet.
And famously, Tati, an early novel, breakthrough novel, I think it could be said, for Christine Dwyer Hickey, dealt with alcoholism seen from the point of view of a child, looking at parents dealing with difficulties around addiction and alcoholism, and had certain echoes of Christine Dwyer Hickey's own life. Here she's putting herself into the mind of the alcoholic himself in the person of Pip. How well does she manage that?
Oh, I think she does it really, really well, because you get the kind of the sense of self-loathing, which I imagine goes along with that. And so, you know, he basically, by this stage, he's 60 years old. He sees his own life as a failure. He sees the broken down relationships. And by this stage, he accepts that he himself has been a major part in why these kind of things have happened. So there's a kind of a... in some ways, he's almost found a peace now with himself. And so there is a sense that he's come through on the other side. And yet, as you said, there's this kind of broken quality to him. That's kind of something that she also does with buildings as well, that the boxing club, which he was part of when he was younger, by the time we get to 2017, he goes back and it's kind of very broken down. The pub, which was thriving in 1979, by 2017 again is in a state of dilapidation. So, you know, she uses buildings in this kind of very metaphorical way to kind of represent where their lives have ended up to.
The buildings also, of course, are direct descriptions of London itself, and London, it could be argued, is the third one of the other very important characters in the novel. I think she lived in London, Christine Dwyer Hickey, for a very brief period of time. She did go and spend time there when she was writing the novel to get the feel of the city, is how she put it herself. How well does she portray London to you?
I think absolutely brilliantly. I mean, in some ways, this is a love letter to London, and, you know, particularly the area around Farringdon and the Barbican, where a lot of the action takes place. Fans of Mick Herron will know all about that too. But there's a sense that she really, in particular, what she's focusing in on here is the experience of the Irish living in London. And you see the full panoply of it, that there are a number of characters who kind of have come into the pub, yeah, who are Irish and absolutely hate London, hate the English, hate everything about it, and are bitter about their experiences. But Millie is not like that. She loves London. And at one stage she says, you know, she kind of reflects that could they start a new life somewhere where they belong, maybe go back to Ireland. But then she realizes that London is where she belongs. And she talks about the kind of awe that she feels for the city. She describes it as always magnificent. So, you know, it's a very complex picture that she's painting here. And she does it, I think, absolutely superbly.
She also brings very real events to play in her description of the novel, in her descriptions of the city in the novel. The funeral of Ronnie Cray is talked about in there, the period of the IRA bombings and how that affected the Irish community in London and in England at the time, and even right up as far as recently as Grenfell, bringing those real historical events and very contemporary events into play. What effect does that have?
I think it's done very well. I mean, there are a couple of things there. That one, when you get to the end of the book, in the acknowledgements, there's a long list of reading that she's done. So she's taken this kind of thing quite seriously to think about the history. But then I think she's also very clever because she looks at these things obliquely. She doesn't look at them in the way that you might write a newspaper article or something like this. It really is seen through the eyes of local people. So, you know, for example, there are passages about Jerry Conlon and the Guildford Four, this kind of thing. But there never feels as if there's anything particularly political about it or two dimensional. That there's a kind of a sense that, you know, everything is still seen through the eyes of Millie or Pip, these two characters. So I think that was a very clever way to deal with these kind of real events experienced by people as if they were there.
You also mentioned the acknowledgements there, and within the acknowledgements and in interviews I've heard Christine Dwyer Hickey speak about T.S. Eliot and the wasteland and how that was part of a spark. We don't need to go into the specifics of it. Part of a spark for the writing of this book. Do you have a sense of the wasteland? Do you have a sense of T.S. Eliot in any way in the writing?
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, I had to draw a little bit on my own undergraduate reading many, many years ago, thinking about T.S. Eliot. But, you know, in some ways, I think that's not just a throwaway line on her part. That, you know, part of The Wasteland, the second part, A Game of Chess, he uses these kind of alternating narrations, just as Hickey does, to illustrate this kind of sense of, you know, the emptiness of life. And so she obviously thought about that and is employing it here, that she quotes Eliot in the text. She has Pip reading it. There's this great line of Eliot's about the damp brown landscape. And in some ways, that's what's going on here and what these two characters are trying to escape really through their own relationship.
The relationship that we see then described, the novel opens with a quotation from Leonard Cohen, every heart to love will come, but like a refugee. Without getting into the specifics of how it all wraps up or doesn't wrap up, as the case may be, how would you describe the Millie and Pip relationship, which is interesting given that we hear from them separately for so long in the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating when we finally arrive in 2017 with both of the characters, so that the kind of the narrative is kind of joined in some ways, although you still hear kind of both the voices. And, you know, you get this kind of this sense of, you know, hope versus desperation, and they veer backwards and forwards between it. That, you know, they're friends, they don't want to spoil that friendship by taking it to the next level, and yet they're both aware that maybe that's kind of something that they should do. But Millie is always kind of saying, well, you know, I don't want hope. She's always saying, I've managed before, you know, and, right, I'll manage again, this kind of thing. So, fine, you know, part of that, the end of the novel is how is this going to resolve itself?
Finally then, Our London Lives, you said it did start slow for you and you wondered if you would stick with it. You did stick with it. Was it worth sticking with, and what's your overall judgment, Richard?
Yeah, no, I actually found this a profoundly moving novel. That, I mean, it does start slowly, but in a way, that's for the reader. It's testing the reader and forcing the reader to engage deeply in this kind of a way. It's a very, very satisfying novel.
A very satisfying novel, The Judgment of Richard Aldous, on Our London Lives by Christine Dwyer Hickey, which is published by Atlantic Books. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Floating on a Dead Sea, sung there by Jane O'Connor. Floating on a Dead Sea is a dance work created, as well as that song, a dance work created by Catherine Young Dance in cooperation with fellow dancers from Palestine. Catherine's connection with Palestine goes back to 2016, a beach in County Kerry. And that all grew from there to a number of trips to Ramallah and Hebron to observe and make connection in the arts and dance world there. Floating on a Dead Sea is inspired by Catherine's time in Palestine, features a cast of international dancers and a visual theatrescape created by Luca Truffarelli. Just arrived in the door in the last half hour or so from Longford, and in studio with me this evening is Catherine Young and two of the Palestinian dancers involved in the work, Lour Amin and Yusuf Arezbai. You're all three very welcome to Arena this evening. And let's go back to a beach in County Kerry, if we can, because it sounds like an unusual spot for the something like this whole dance piece to have started in your mind. How did it start, Catherine?
Yeah, I was working with folks from Direct Provision in Kerry, and I was looking for ways to connect communities, and I was invited to make a piece for the Festival of Welcomes for the 1916 celebrations that were going to happen on Banna Beach by Fergus O'Cruar. So it was a time of the height of the refugee crisis when people were being washed up on beaches. So I felt that if we were performing something on a beach, then it needed to address that issue. And one of the guys that joined the project was Ahmed Lulu from Gaza, an amazing, lovely, lovely, lovely guy. And he taught us Dabka. So in the show, we had Irish dance and African dance, and anybody who came from a particular country, we invited them to share their dance style. So he taught
Dabka us... Dabka being a Palestinian style dance.
Yes, the traditional dance from Palestine. So he taught us that. That ended up in the show. And then when we were remounting the show for Culture Night, one of the dancers made friends with another dancer, Salma Ataya, who had arrived in Ireland to study. And she did the show with us. And unbeknownst to me, she sent the trailer of the show over to Ramallah, to the festival there, the Ramallah Contemporary Dance Festival. So I got an email asking me if we would bring the show to Palestine. So 13 of us ended up going out to collaborate with Sidi at Ramallah in 2017. So that was my first. None of it was planned. It just suddenly grew from Kerry. We ended up in Palestine.
And I think, Yusuf, did you at the time of that visit, or maybe perhaps it was later, that you started working? I think you did a set of workshops with Catherine Young Dance.
It was a bit later after that.
Yeah,
yes,
the second visit.
We got to meet and to speak a little bit, and then Catherine offered us an opportunity to be part of the show and to be filmed. And from there, it took on.
Yeah. Maybe I could ask, rather than asking Dabka to describe your traditional dance, the Palestinian Dabka style of dancing or type of traditional dance, I think I'm told that, in fact, Lour is the person to ask about this.
I would say Lour.
Yeah. So, Lour, can you describe the dance to me, what it does and what place it has in Palestinian tradition?
Yeah, so it evolved from the from working in building houses. So Palestinians used to work, used to build houses from mud, and they would put their feet in the mud and like mix the mud with water, mix the soil with water. And with that movement, we Palestinians like to feel joy in everything we do. So in working, they used to like hold hands and then do the dabka. And it's basically very grounded, and it concentrates on the feet, the knees. It's it's very down to earth. And then it evolved to become like the dance of the weddings, and like a traditional dance for weddings and the celebrations.
I really so, because I was looking, there's a film project attached to this, which we'll talk a little bit more about. And I was looking at a young woman, it's a 15-year-old girl, in fact, who dances the dance. And the feet are stamped down on the ground. Is this about making sure the mud is compact and tight together so that it's solid brick? Yeah. A good solid brick. You mentioned that it became part of weddings, dances, and you know, community events, things like that. Laura, I'm wondering, when you dance it now, what does it signify for you? What feeling does it have for you?
Well, a lot actually, because it's so any cultural like behavior or cultural thing has to evolve with the people. So our experiences now are different. We don't build houses with mud, but we do other stuff. And our daily experiences are also embedded in dabke. So for me, I feel like it's more about our daily lives, our struggles, our even like passing through checkpoints. You can see that in dabke. And like
explain to me a little bit about, you know, working as you would if you were at home. What are the daily difficulties of simply making it into a dance studio to rehearse a piece or to work on a piece?
The daily difficulties. Okay. Well, mentally, first of all, it's difficult because doing art, for example, in this situation where people in Gaza are facing genocide and bombing and hunger, it's very difficult to like be separated or to focus on art or dance when other people are suffering, and or actually our families and our people are suffering. So this is our like, we have to like confront this mental problem, and then we will find ourselves, no, we need to go on, we need to like we need to work together to like reach our goal, and we can't stop, we can't even like hold back.
So you have to confront that mental issue, and then quite simply the physical, the one that you've touched on, going through checkpoints, making your way maybe through unsafe situations and unsafe areas just to simply get there.
Yes, it is unsafe because most of the dancers are from Ramallah, but some are from villages around Ramallah, some are from Jerusalem, so it's different from one person to another. But for example, if someone from Jerusalem wants to come to Ramallah for a rehearsal, it might be impossible if the checkpoint is closed, for example.
Yeah.
Or if there are any situation or any military in the road, it will be like very stressful.
And I presume you have to have permits and all sort of traveling, all sorts of traveling documents for this to happen, which, Yosef, makes it difficult in some ways around the subject of dance, because in the film Catherine ended up making this documentary about the time in Palestine. And I think it's you within the film that talks about the joy that dancing gives to you, the freedom that it gives to you.
Yeah.
To find that within the sort of situations that Laura has described to us there, the mental difficulty of getting past the suffering and the difficulties of others to a point where you can just dance for joy.
Yeah.
How difficult is that?
I think there's like a sense of you don't have much control over your time or over what is happening in your life. And dance gives you a certain space to feel that kind of control, that against all probabilities of if anyone else was in this position, then they would feel desperate and they wouldn't do much because they're so limited and everything is controlled in their life. For example, like where I grew up in Silwan in Jerusalem, if I take a small walk, there's at least 30 cameras all around me. There's at least 4 checkpoints. There's 2 settlements that are covering everything that I can see. So you're constantly having this sense of being watched, being controlled. And dancing gave me a small space where I could really face my inner problems, my thoughts, my view of life. And at the same time, it made me connect, because I feel there's a specific situation in Palestine where Lour, for example, is in the West Bank, I'm in Jerusalem. Geographically, we're very close, but these checkpoints make it so hard for me to understand her reality and her to understand mine, as the same if it's up in the north or if it's in Gaza. So we have a shared community that has the same culture, that has the same language, that has the same passion, but and geographically is so close, but because of this situation, they live completely different realities. And dance gives you the space of being common and talking about these kind of things.
Let me go to that clip I mentioned, the 15-year-old girl. I don't know if you can remember her name.
Rand.
who is here. She's dancing the dabka as we're watching her. That's where I saw the stamping feet. And she's describing what the dance means for her, or what it allows her to do.
My name is Ragd. I'm 15 years old. I live in Aydakam. I'm a refugee from Adjour village. Dancing dabka, in my opinion, it's one kind of resisting the Israeli occupation. It's very hard to live under occupation in Aydakam, because Aydakam is surrounded by 6 military tower and also an apartheid wall. So it's very difficult to react with this this life, because the Israel occupation all the time enter our homes in the midnight. They arrested the children, the parents, the boys, and also the girls. When I come to Lajee Center to dance and also to play music, I feel very happy and very strong, because even if we have an occupation, we dance, we play music to send a message to the world. Even if we have an occupation, but we are strong. Our children are strong, and we want to have a good culture to face the occupation. We want to face them with our culture.
Clip there from Catherine Young's. It's a documentary film, essentially, Catherine, of the period, the time you spent in Palestine ahead of the making of this show, Floating on the Dead Sea, that you're speaking to us about this evening, along with the dancers Lour Amin and Yusuf Ali-Sabai. That description of the difficulties of occupation, you were there. We see a lot of stuff on the television, we get a sense of it, but you experienced it at first hand, even for that short period you were there. And it wasn't as bad as it is right now, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. What did you experience?
Where to start? There's a real physical, visceral experience in your body. I think, you know, before you go, you think you understand human rights and you think you understand it all. But when you go there and your body, you know, has to go through a fraction of what people there live, your body is different. You know, it's tense, it's on edge. And it's usually around checkpoints. Being around Palestinians is always really amazing and really comforting. But I think it's just there's so much that they have to contend with on a daily basis that we don't. You take your rights for granted. And I think after that trip, it probably changed me as a human fundamentally forever. In terms of
and Lour, I noticed as we were listening to the music there, you were watching the news on the television, and inevitably there were pictures coming from, I think it was from Lebanon, but you know, we could see the nearness of Palestine and of the West Bank and in those areas on the map that was on the television at the time. Being here, first of all, how difficult is that when you know what's going on at home?
Well, it's very difficult actually, because you feel like you're far, but also very near. Like I think like Catherine said, it's in your body. Like I feel the pain of my people in my body. I feel the grief and the suffering, and I can't just ignore that. I need I need to do something about it.
I presume dancing, though, is a way of expressing that pain. Does it expunge? Does it get rid of the pain in any way?
It helps to understand it, I think. I don't think it helps to relieve, but I think it's a way of expression and a way of conveying messages. So we understand our feelings and emotions through our bodies, and this is why we dance. And this is how we, for example, how we do dabke. If we want to be fighters, for example, we fight in dabke. If we want to be resilient, we become resilient in dabke. If we want to feel grief in dabke, then we can do that also.
So you use the dance to express those various emotions. And Yosef, in terms of a sense of freedom, mm-hmm. you say you get it when you're at home, mm-hmm. you get it through dance. And I was watching some of the movements you were making in the documentary film, and I noticed how internalized a lot of what you were doing was, even though it was beautiful to watch. What sense do you have around freedom when you're here in Ireland?
Well, there's a completely, I would say, a complete different sense for it, because when you're in that situation in Palestine, you do realize that there's something wrong with human rights, with how much freedom you have. But you don't really realize it until you are out of it and seeing it from outside, because it gets so normalized. It's the only way that you can cope with it. You have to numb your emotions to a certain extent in order to stay sane with what you see, because everything around you is so surreal and so sometimes violent in a sense that you have to put your emotions in a box and close on it. And then you start to view everything as normal. Even the violence is normal to some extent. But then when you take a step back and you view it from a privileged point of view, that I would describe it, then you realize, it's not everyone who's suffering. It's certain places, in a sense. And it shouldn't be anywhere. So it opened my perspective on what freedom is. So I do feel a sense of freedom when I'm dancing. But at the same time, I'm still aware of how limited that freedom is.
What does being part of this show mean for you briefly? I'll come to both yourself and Lure on this one.
For me, I always, when I meet Irish people, I feel like there's a shared sense of history. There's an understanding and a sensibility. So for me, it feels great to be able to be connected with my heritage, to be able to dance with other Palestinians, because I don't always get that chance.
Yes. And for you, Lure?
It's an interesting experience, actually, because we don't really, like in El Funun, in Palestine, we don't really collaborate with other groups.
And for the reasons that Yosef is just describing.
And it's very difficult to travel, and even like dancers might also be banned from traveling and stuff. And I feel like this experience is very... I'm very privileged to have it, actually. And I feel what's important about it is not the show, but it's the whole process before that, like working together and living together.
That collaboration.
Yeah,
well, I feel privileged that the two of you, along with Catherine, are with us in the studio this evening. Thank you so much for coming in. That is Lure Amin, Yosef Arisbai, and of course Catherine Young. Catherine, Lure and Yosef will be part of Floating on a Dead Sea, which will begin its 8-venue tour of Ireland at the Backstage Theatre in Longford, and it tours to the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary November the 2nd. Full information, there are other venues as well. Full information on CatherineYoungDance.com. I'm trying to say all of this without getting another coughing fit. Tonight's programme, that's our lot. Tonight's programme was researched by Paula Shields. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Mark Dwyer was on sound, and the programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.